So today I hope to take you on a quick tour of Ayurveda. It's an ancient system of healing that's over 5,000 years old. So I'm probably going to give it about 50 minutes. So the ratio of 5,000 to 50 is pretty intense, but we're going to try and cover a lot of ground in that area, in that time. And what I'm hoping to do today is really give a little bit of a theoretical overview of the discipline, and then talk a little bit about how we might each be able to apply some of those principles to ourselves in terms of creating an optimal lifestyle that encourages our best performance in all realms of life. And Ayurveda really is dedicated to bringing out the fullest potential at the body, mind, and spirit level. So I'm just going to start out by defining the word Ayurveda. Ayurveda comes from two Sanskrit roots, ayur, meaning having to do with life or living, and Veda, meaning wisdom or knowledge. So systematized wisdom or knowledge is sometimes called science. So sometimes it's translated as science of living, sometimes as wisdom of living, sometimes knowledge of right living. All of those definitions really speak to the idea of Ayurveda as a system for not just treating illness or disease, but for actually creating optimal health in each of the individuals that uses that discipline. Now, in the Ayurvedic worldview, every single thing in the cosmos, including we human beings, are actually composed of five great elements. And this is bhuta, five great bhutas, or elements. That's a Sanskrit word for it. And these five great elements are space, air, fire, water, and earth. Now, when we talk about elements in this context, we're not talking about the physical substance of fire or the physical substance of air. We're actually talking more about the qualities that are embodied in these substances. So, for example, you know, fire would be the quality of heat or illumination. Water would be the quality of fluidity. Earth would be the quality of stability or solidity. So in the Ayurvedic worldview, these five great elements in all different permutations and combinations account for the entire universe as we know it. Now, these five great elements, when they come together to form sentient life, they are transmutated into a little bit more of a subtle form, which are called doshas. So doshas are bioenergetic forces, which are actually the result of the pairing of the great elements. So space and air come together to form vata dosha. Fire and water come together to form pitta dosha. And water and earth come together to form kapha dosha. So I just wanted to say that this diagram is something that we're going to have to come back to multiple times and refer back to this, because even though it's a fairly simple diagram, it actually contains a lot of profound information in terms of why Ayurveda recommends what it does in terms of treatments or in terms of its assessments. And so it's really important to understand that these qualities of space, air, fire, water, and earth, and understanding these qualities is really instrumental to understanding the whole Ayurvedic worldview. So, when we talk about the qualities of space and air, in Ayurveda, space and air have qualities of lightness, of coldness, of dryness, of mobility. So when these come together to form vata dosha, in all sentient life forms, in all living beings, whether they're animals or humans, these three great doshas are responsible for everything that we consider to be life: respiration, digestion, breathing, thinking, feeling, reacting, movement, all of these. But each of these doshas, vata, pitta, and kapha, sort of govern or rule certain aspects of sentient life. So space and air, these qualities of space and air come together and form vata dosha. And vata dosha is responsible for all movement in human beings or in all sentient life. So when we talk about movement here, we're talking not only about voluntary movement, but also involuntary movement. And I'm just going to talk about that a little bit in my next slide. But just sort of hold this idea that vata is a force of movement. The other next dosha I want to talk about is pitta dosha. Pitta dosha is almost all fire with just a little bit of water also combined in it. The pitta dosha, because it's mostly fire, it has to do with the qualities of fire. When we think about fire, we think of something that's sharp, penetrating, hot, illuminating. And pitta, in fact, has a lot of these qualities in terms of its functions within the sentient life forms. So pitta dosha, we consider the sort of fire of transformation in the human body and in all sentient life. So whether that transformation is a very physiological, concrete transformation, like the digestive process is considered a form of transformation, or whether it's at a more mental level, Pitta dosha is the dosha of transformation, the energy of transformation in the body. The third dosha is Kapha dosha. And Kapha is formed by water and earth, the great elements of water and earth coming together. Think about what water and earth, when they combine, form. Sort of like mud, right? Really thick, heavy, static. And these are some of the qualities of Kapha dosha. Kapha dosha is responsible for all of the binding energy in the body and in the mind and in all sentient life. Binding, lubricating, protecting, these are all qualities of Kapha dosha. So just, this is the quick overview of these three doshas, and I'm going to talk in the next slide about a little bit more detail about each of these doshas. So the very important concept to understand about doshas is that every dosha, each of the three doshas, has a very specific expression at every dimension of the human being. So Vata dosha manifests as movement at the body level, at the mind level, and at more subtle energetic levels that you might want to call spiritual or consciousness or metaphysical, whatever you want to call that realm. It also is manifested at that level. And then same thing with Pitta. Pitta has manifestations at the somatic level, at the psychological level, and then at more subtle levels that you might want to call spiritual. Kapha has, again, manifestation of body, mind, and spirit level. And this is very important because this is not, because in the Ayurvedic worldview, it's not that Vata controls the body, Pitta controls the mind, and Kapha controls the spirit. It's not like that. It's each of these doshas is actually present at every single dimension of the human being. And that, in fact, even down to the cellular level. So even at the cellular level, Vata has manifestation, Pitta has manifestation, and Kapha has manifestation. So I want to say a little bit more about how these might manifest at each of these levels, just to give you a little bit of a sense of something that might be very abstract as I'm speaking. So Vata is the energy of movement. So at the body level, at the somatic level, that would translate into all voluntary movements, all involuntary movements like breathing. Well, breathing is sort of part voluntary, part involuntary. But let's say the beating of the heart, peristalsis of the GI tract, involuntary blinking of the eye. All of that would be considered a manifestation of Vata at the somatic level. At the psychological level, Vata is also the force of movement of the mind. In fact, we always say that what is the fastest entity of all? We say it's the mind in Ayurveda, because the mind can take you anywhere from here to the outer realm of the galaxy, just like that. You think about it and you're there. And so the mind is supposed to be the swiftest, most, the quickest moving entity of all. So that the movement of the mind, the natural tendency of the mind to jump from thought to thought, from feeling to feeling, from, you know, focus of attention from here to there, that tendency of the mind to move is considered to be part of Vata. And then at the most subtle level, Vata is considered to manifest as prana. Prana is, at the most subtle level, the life force. This is in Ayurveda, the principle of just what do we consider the vital force that determines whether someone is dead or alive, and that's prana. So we say that Vata, at the most subtle level, is manifest as prana. Now, Pitta dosha, at the somatic level, Pitta is the energy of transformation, heat, assimilation, digestion. These are all aspects of Pitta. So at the somatic level, Pitta would be manifest, for example, as our body's capacity to generate heat. So maintaining a constant body temperature of 98.6 degrees. That would be an example of Pitta, and the physiological functioning of Pitta, thermogenesis. And then also the digestive enzymes, the ability to heat up, you know, chemically the food that we take in and then break it down and digest it. That's considered also a manifestation of Pitta. And then at the more subtle psychological level, the force of Pitta manifests as the capacity of the mind to digest the perceptions and information that are taken in from the outside world, and then you sort of digest and assimilate them into something that is a useful action or a useful game plan or an understanding of something. So that ability to take in information, but then really sort of digest it, assimilate it into one's being is a manifestation of Pitta. And this is very important. In fact, when we say, someone is very, very smart, we might say, oh, they're really bright or they're really sharp. And these are actually qualities of pitta, qualities of fire, which pitta is mostly considered to be made up of. And then at the most subtle level, pitta is manifest in the Ayurvedic view as tejas. Tejas is brilliance. It's translated as brilliance. So prana is life force. It's whether we are alive or dead, whether we have this movement of energetic force going through us. But how vital, how bright is that life force? How brilliant is it? You know, is it very, very weak or is it really strong and robust? So tejas is that sense of brilliance to the life force that permeates the being. And so at the most subtle level, pitta is manifest as tejas. Then kapha dosha, at the somatic level, we talked about kapha being the force of binding, the force of lubrication. So at the somatic level, the ability of the body to actually create more body mass, to create more cellular mass, for example, that would be a manifestation of kapha. So a growing child, you know, who weighs 30 pounds last year and now weighs 40 pounds this year, he gained an extra 10 pounds. And that 10 pounds, we say, is a manifestation of kapha working. So in children, kapha dosha is actually a very, very strong force in children. But unfortunately, even as we age, kapha can sometimes be a very interesting and important force too, as we gain weight and as we perhaps slow down a little bit and become a little more static and a little more sort of deliberate in the way we operate. These are all manifestations of kapha dosha. Again, at the somatic level, not only the amassing of body tissue, but also the lubrication of the joints, the lubrication of the alveoli, the forming of mucus throughout the body, this is all considered also a manifestation of kapha at the somatic level. Because remember, kapha is water, mostly, and earth. So think about those qualities of water and earth when you think about kapha. So water and earth binds, but water and earth also lubricates and moistens. And so that's one of the primary functions of kapha. At the mental level, the psychological level, kapha, the binding force of kapha, is manifest in one way as memory. So our ability to hold on to information, to bind the information that we hear and be able to really recall it when we need it, that's an expression of kapha at the mental level. And then also kapha at an interpersonal level, the ability to form interpersonal bonds, to bind ourselves to another person, that ability to be caring, empathic, loving, that's also considered to be a manifestation of kapha. So at the psychological level, kapha manifests these tendencies as well. And then at the most subtle level, ojas is a manifestation of kapha, that sort of metaphysical or spiritual level. And ojas roughly translates into resilience or stamina, if you want to call it that. So it's the ability to sort of, you know, fight off and protect oneself in the face of whatever adversities might beset us. So that ability to just sort of have a certain kind of resilience and stamina in the face of stress, that's a manifestation of kapha at the most subtle level. So prana, tejas, and ojas are at the most subtle level of manifestation of vata, pitta, and kapha. But for the most of this talk, we're going to be focusing more on body and mind, although we can certainly also talk a little bit about the manifestations of these forces at the metaphysical level. But a lot of the rest of this talk really has to do with how vata, pitta, and kapha sort of manifest at the body-mind level and how we might be able to use this information in terms of guiding our own lifestyle choices. So in Ayurveda, every single human being has vata, pitta, and kapha within themselves. But every single person has a very unique proportion of vata, pitta, and kapha. So it's sort of like a bioenergetic fingerprint. No two people will have exactly the same proportions of vata, pitta, and kapha. All three are necessary for life, but every single person has a different proportion of these. And this is very, very important to understand in Ayurveda what this proportion is. This proportion is called your constitution. And you're born with this constitution, essentially. And in the Ayurvedic worldview, health or optimal living comes out of making lifestyle choices that keep you in balance with your basic constitution of vata, pitta, and kapha. Because unfortunately, these three doshas can be thrown off balance based on various lifestyle choices. And I'll talk about that in just a minute. But based on how you live your life, you can either keep vata, pitta, and kapha in the proportions that you were born with, and that's considered to be your point of strength, your sort of source of power and maximal resilience in the face of stress. And then when you are off balance in terms of vata, pitta, and kapha, then you're much more vulnerable to dealing with whatever stresses come at you. You're much more vulnerable to developing some kind of distress or some kind of symptoms as a result of that. And in Ayurveda, this is sort of the explanation for why the same stressor might affect 10 different people in 10 different ways, depending on how much in balance they are or not in terms of their constitution. So if someone comes in coughing and sneezing into a room with 10 people, you know, some people might walk away from that encounter with absolutely no ill effects whatsoever, and they just keep going on their merry way. And maybe other people will feel a little bit under the weather for a day or two, but then kind of recuperate very quickly and move on. And maybe somebody else will just come down with the flu for 2 weeks and be completely out flat for that period of time. So Ayurveda would say, well, that's because this differential response is because each of those individuals who encountered the exact same stressor in the form of this virus or whatever it was that was being spewed into the environment, that these people had different internal capacity to sort of meet that stress and to overcome it based on how much in harmony they were with their basic constitution. So the goal in Ayurveda is to understand what your constitution is and then to make wise lifestyle choices that keep you in balance with that constitution so that you have maximal resilience in the face of stress. And that stress can come in any form. It can come in the form of, you know, a viral or bacterial illness, or it can come in the form of emotional stress, or it can come in the form of financial stress or interpersonal stress, whatever it is. But you will have maximum resilience to meet that stress if you're living in balance with your constitution. So how does one determine constitution in the Ayurvedic worldview? So Ayurveda says that, first of all, because going back to that definition of health, health is when you are in optimal balance in terms of your constitution. So what Ayurveda says is, well, let's think back to when you were at your optimal functioning, you know, in your life, at every level, body, mind, and spirit level. Let's think about a time when you were at your best functioning. And we will take that to be the point at which you were most in balance in terms of your doshas. And so let's think back to that point in time. Now, and when I actually do these assessments with my patients, I'll actually try to get them to even think of like a specific, you know, month of a specific year. So in May 1985, when this person was 25 years old, they really felt that they were at their optimal functioning. So then I'll ask them a series of questions, okay, saying, okay, when you were 25 years old in May 1985, I want you to answer these questions for me. And depending on how that person answers the questions, I will have a sense of how much vata was in their constitution, how much pitta is in their constitution, how much kapha is in their constitution at that point of optimal health. And so the questions that I'll ask will have to do with a variety of different mind-body parameters. So Ayurveda really has an exhaustive list of questions and that are designed to get at different parameters, mind-body. Some of them are physical. So, for example, I will look at body build and weight and think about, well, where were they when they were 25? What was their body build? What was their body weight? And then I compare it to where they are now. So that will give me a sense of, okay, here's where they were at their optimal functioning, and here's where they are now. And then that gives me an idea of which dosha or set of doshas is most changed or most affected. Now, if there's somebody that, you know, is in great health and is taking really great care of themselves, there won't be much difference between how they would answer these questions from when they were at their optimal point of health to how they were how they would answer them now. But for a lot of people, there is a big difference in one dosha or another. And so depending on which dosha is most affected, that will determine the course of treatment in terms of helping them to bring back that particular dosha. But this form of assessment is very important and critical, not just for illness, but also if someone is curious, you know, well, how do I maintain my health? How do I keep going? You know, so far, you know, thank goodness everything is going fine and I'm feeling pretty good, but how do I maintain that? And what can I do in terms of lifestyle that will keep me in balance so that I won't get thrown off balance? And so Ayurvedic assessments have a very, very important function in also maintaining wellness. So some of the parameters, as I mentioned, are physical in terms of body build and weight. I will look at their tongue. I will look at their skin, look at their hair and nails, because again, in each of these parameters, vata, pitta, and kapha will manifest in a certain way. So for example, and I'll talk about this more in my next slide, but just to take one example, in terms of body build, a vata person, think about vata being a combination of space and air. A vata person has a lot of lightness inherently built into their constitution. So vata people will generally tend to be very lean and very light in terms of their overall body build and shape. They might be very, very tall and skinny or very small and petite, but in general they'll have a leanness and slimness to them, and they will be one of those people that will really have a difficult time putting on weight. You know, their problems in adolescence might have been that they had a hard time, you know, gaining weight with the rest of their classmates, and even now they tend to lose weight if they're under stress or if, you know, they're not taking care of themselves properly. So that has to do with the vata, the quality of air and space being such an inherent part of that person. Now, the pitta person, their body build will actually be a lot more what we would say fiery. It would be a lot more sort of powerful and a lot more robust and a lot more having a tendency towards precision and sharpness and sort of the quality of heat. So that might manifest as a ruddy complexion or sharp features or a very, very forceful way of walking or speaking in terms of their overall body habitus. So this would be just one example. And then kapha people would have a tendency to really be very, very sturdy and well-built, maybe tending towards overweight very easily. So it wouldn't take much for a kapha-type person to put on body weight. But in general, these are very large individuals, not necessarily fat, but just very large and very big-boned, proportionately large in terms of both height and girth many times. So this is just one example. So then I might add some. So as a child, or as a, you know, at your point of optimal health, you know, what was your body build like, and how is it now, and how much has it changed, if at all? And that gives me one indication of which parameter in terms of vata, pitta, and kapha may have changed. And so I go through a whole list of questions like this, and Ayurveda gets very, very precise about a lot of parameters. I mean, what I've listed here are just some of them. You know, eating and elimination patterns. You know, so we might ask, well, how many bowel movements a day do you have? And sometimes people will look at me and say, what does that have to do with treating my depression? You know, but in the Ayurvedic worldview, it does, because vata, pitta, and kapha govern peristalsis, they govern digestion, they govern all kinds of things. And so we need to understand who this person is in all of these different dimensions. And then sleep patterns and so on and so forth. So I'm going to just give you this slide for a minute, which tries to put together some of the information, some of the key information in terms of body-mind parameters and how they might manifest in a given individual. And again, remember, every single person has vata, pitta, and kapha. So no one is going to be missing one of the doshas. Every single person has all three. All three are critical for life. But we say that usually there's a predominance of one dosha or sometimes two doshas in that person. So when we speak here about constitutional types, what we're talking about is vata predominance, pitta predominance, or kapha predominance. We're not talking about the person being all vata or all pitta or all kapha. But we say that in general, you know, one or two of these doshas may predominate in the person's mind, body, spirit, being. And so how would that look if that person had a lot of vata, a lot of pitta, or a lot of kapha in their constitutional makeup? So as I said, vata is a combination of air and space. So that's going to translate in terms of physically, you know, into having a very lean, bony build. Many times these are individuals that will have a very rapid way of speaking or moving or going about doing things. Because again, think about air and space. You know, think about wind. Wind is very erratic. Sometimes it goes whoosh like this in gusts, and then other times it's just very, very still. So that quality of like erraticness and unpredictability is an aspect of vata. And so that really determines like a lot of the vata physiological traits, like being ravenous 1 minute and then being completely satiated 5 minutes later and having nothing in between. And stamina levels also being very, very erratic in that way. Now, we had said that vata has a lot of air and space as a part of its constitution, and that some of the qualities of air and space inherently are coldness and mobility and lightness. So vata people are going to be very sensitive to any external wind and cold because they already have a lot of internal wind and cold. And so for Vata people, since they already have so much of that in their internal makeup, it doesn't take much from the outside in terms of those qualities to make them feel a little uncomfortable or off balance. So they're going to be the people that are going to be putting on sweaters and putting on, you know, a lot of layers when everybody else is feeling just fine in the room. And they're like, oh, is there air conditioning on? And you know, they're putting on sweaters and so on. Because they just have that inherent sensitivity to the wind and cold. Now, at the mental level, Vata predominant people, when they are in balance, that remember we had talked about the movement of the mind as being an aspect of Vata? So that movement can manifest as a very quick, creative, flexible mind when it's in balance. And so Vata people can be great at dreaming up ideas and, you know, almost being able to almost sometimes like see into the future in terms of like knowing a trend and being able to have a very intuitive sense of which direction, you know, the spirit of the times is blowing. In, it's like a very, very, very positive aspect of Vata when it's in balance. And when it's not so much in balance, if the Vata dosha is off balance in that individual, if it's excessive or aggravated, unfortunately, that creative, quick, flexible mind can also then become very, very anxious and unsettled and unable to focus. So it becomes very erratic, and that movement is kind of unpredictable, unfocused movement rather than being channeled in a particular direction. So all of these qualities, in terms of Vata, Pitta, and Kapha, they have positive aspects when they're in balance, and they have negative aspects when they're off balance. So no one of these is better or, you know, somehow more desirable than the other. It's just about being able to tap into the positive qualities by staying in balance. So Vata individuals also, in terms of mental activity, because the mind is so flexible and movable, sometimes Vata people have a difficult time making decisions and sticking to them. It's like they're always great at being able to say, well, that's a good choice, but what about if we went this way? And then that has some really good benefits too. But then maybe we should go back to this way. So there's a lot of vacillation with Vata, a lot of that movement and erraticness that can sometimes take over. And then in terms of memory, Vata people are very good at learning. They're very good, very quick. But sometimes they forget stuff really quickly too. They learn things very quickly, but then if you ask them a week later, their retention rates might not be so great. So that's one of the aspects of Vata, mentally. So because these are some of the qualities of Vata that air and space elements bring to the person, we want to counterbalance air and space qualities as much as possible to keep that person in balance. So for Vata, we want to, for example, encourage a lot of warmth in the food that they eat, in the environment that they're in, because there's so much inherent coldness in Vata in terms of the air and space qualities having a lot of coolness attached to them. So we want to counterbalance that by, as much as possible, keeping Vata predominant people warm. And so we encourage them to eat rich, warm foods that are a little bit heating, so a little bit of spice is good for Vata. And if they have an opportunity to pick, you know, where they're going to go on vacation, a Vata person, if they really want to feel rested and recuperated, they need to go to a nice, warm, humid environment like Hawaii or the tropics. You know, for Vatas, if they really want to feel settled, trying to go on a windy hike, you know, up some steep mountain slope, that's actually going to aggravate Vata. That's actually going to create more air and space and coolness from external sources. And so the internal Vata is less likely to feel calmed down as a result. Now, that doesn't mean that Vata people can't go on mountain hikes, but it means that they need to understand that they're going to have to take extra steps then, you know, to try and maintain warmth and to maybe consider, you know, having a warm steam bath at the end of that hike or, you know, taking something with them that'll provide a lot of warmth on the journey. And this is one of the ways to take this into account in terms of the lifestyle choices that you might make. And then because Vata is so erratic and so changeable in its nature, the way to help Vata people, even though they'll resist this with all their might because their, you know, their constitution is so not into this, but what they really need is structure and regularity, because structure and regularity is what helps to ground Vata. It's the thing that gives that erratic, movable sort of airspace energy some focus and some predictability. And so it's very, very important if Vata people are going to function well that they sleep at the same time every day, that they eat meals at the same time every day, and that they have a really nice, long sleep. You know, lots of people, we really encourage them, 8 hours of sleep isn't enough. You know, sleep nine and a half, sleep 10 sometimes if you need it, because vatas are really going to benefit from that extra rest, because they have such a tendency to expend so much energy and movement during the day. They really need that recuperative energy. Now, I'm just going to move on quickly now to pitta. So pitta people, remember we said, have a predominance of fire. A little bit of water, but predominance of fire in the pitta constitution. So what that translates into at the somatic level is a sense of forcefulness and power at the physical level. So they're very powerfully built usually, have a lot of muscle mass, have a very forceful way of expressing themselves. They have very, very strong appetites many times, strong stamina. But because there's so much internal heat in pitta, first of all, anything that in terms of external heat is very likely to throw them off balance. So pitta people hate hot weather. You know, they're the kind of people that will, you know, just kind of strip down to whatever they can strip down at the slightest bit of warmth in terms of the day outside. They hate, they sweat very, very easily with just the least amount of heat. They hate that sort of clammy, hot sensation of being out in hot weather. So it doesn't take much in terms of external heat to throw a pitta person off. And then similarly, external heat, like in terms of food that you eat, will also throw off a pitta person. So pitta people might love spice, but spicy food, because it's supposed to have a lot of quality of fire in it, will also make a pitta person really easily go off balance. So when the pitta person is in balance, at the mental level, that sort of sharpness of mind, that sharpness of fire, will lead to a very quick, very intelligent mind. You know, something that can, a mind that can really just look at the situation and make an assessment and be right on target. You know exactly what's required in that situation and really be able to come up with a very appropriate plan for that scenario. So ER physicians, for example, are many times blessed with great pitta minds because they might not have all of the information available to them, but they're very good at looking at the information that they do have, putting it together, coming up with the right diagnosis, and coming up with a plan of treatment that will really help save that person's life in that moment. So these are very, very good leaders, very, very good thinkers. Many CEOs of companies will have a lot of pitta qualities predominating. And when they're in balance, they're wonderful leaders and often have a very devoted following in terms of people in their company or people in their program really trusting their instincts and being able to follow their lead. But when pitta is off balance, whether it's due to external heat, internal heat, or contact with other sort of heat, what we would say elements of heat in terms of external stressors, and that might even involve, for example, we would say, alcohol, a lot of sexual activity, a lot of sensual activity, those are all supposed to also be heating in Ayurveda. So an excess of all of those activities is supposed to throw the pitta person off balance much more easily than the other two constitutional types. And so when a pitta person indulges in lifestyle choices that have too much heat, that internal heat is aggravated, and then that person gets thrown off balance in terms of pitta. And so what does that manifest as? Many times that will manifest as a kind of irritability and tendency towards anger, very like a hair trigger anger, very competitive or very jealous kind of strivings, and an inability to really let go of something and just kind of hold on to it with a kind of competitive spirit and just sort of ruthlessly try to obtain your goal no matter what the costs are. Those are sometimes some manifestations of pitta, when pitta goes off balance, when it goes awry. So those exact same leadership qualities that can be wonderful when they're in balance can also really work against the person, you know, when they're off balance. And so the beloved leader might become a tyrant. You know, and the leader that was able to make really good choices that really took the whole picture into account and really lead, you know, the company into the right direction, they might make a very self-centered decision based on maybe rivalry with this other person and that not thinking about the company as a whole, for example. So those would be examples of the pitta mind when it's off balance, not making a very good decision. Now, the Pitta person, because they have so much internal fire, in terms of what lifestyle recommendations we make for them, those are recommendations that will help to counterbalance all of the internal heat by producing more coolness and a little bit more of the heaviness also. Because Pitta, even though it's hot, it also has some light qualities. And so for Pittas, what we recommend, for example, is whenever possible, keeping their external environment cool, but also in terms of their meals, eating cool foods. So salads, for example, are great for Pitta. Sort of cool, light food is good for Pitta. But salads with some, like, say, tofu thrown in or something, for a little bit of weight in there. But for a Pitta person, we also need to consider tastes, because in Ayurveda, I'll get to this in just a minute, but in Ayurveda, all of the different tastes also have an effect on Vata, Pitta, and Kapha. And sweet is supposed to be the best counterbalance to hot, actually. So we recommend cool and sweet foods, and we recommend cool environments, and we recommend a moderate amount of sleep. Not as much sleep as for Vata, but as you'll hear, not as little as for Kapha. So somewhere just in between for Pitta. So let's move on now to the Kapha predominant individual. So the Kapha predominant individual has a lot of water and earth inherent in their constitution. So that's going to manifest as a very large, hefty build and a sense of deliberateness in the way they move, in the way they speak, in the way that they will think and come to decisions. And then because Kapha has a lot of dampness and a lot of coldness as a part of its inherent constitution, the Kapha person is going to be most sensitive to foggy, cold climates. So actually, like the kind of weather we had last week before it got all sunny, that would be the kind of weather that Kapha people would do the worst in, because that external dampness and coldness will really aggravate that inner quality in Kapha. And so when the Kapha person is in balance, you know, that quality of water and earth creating that stability, that sort of groundedness, that will manifest as a very deliberate-minded person. Someone who's very, very slow to get angry, who's very forgiving, who's very, remember Kapha dosha was the energy of binding, so very forgiving, very loving, very caring when they're in balance. When they're off balance, like because of aggravation of this Kapha dosha, then those same qualities take on more negative aspects. So what might have been a steady deliberateness in terms of the way that they would go about making a decision, maybe that would turn into a kind of ruminative style, you know, where it's like clinging and holding on too much, it's binding too much to an old memory and not able to move forward from that memory. And maybe becoming very, very lethargic, very slowed down, almost frozen or paralyzed sometimes. So those would be some aspects of Kapha when it's off balance. The Kapha individual when they're off balance. So to counterbalance that, you know, tendency of coldness and dampness, which is inherent in Kapha, we want to really see if we can introduce lifestyle choices that will create lightness, spiciness, and warmth in that person, because these are all qualities that will counterbalance the dampness and coldness and heaviness of Kapha. And so for Kapha, we say light and spicy meals. Warm, light, and spicy is really important. So something like warm soup would be good for Kapha. But even the water element is already there in Kapha, so maybe not so much of a water element, but, you know, a little bit of a watery soup would be good. Or having something like some kind of like a spicy light cracker. That would be a good, but warmed if you can have it, like a warm, spicy cracker with some spices on it. So that would be a really good Kapha sort of snack to have. We'll get into the Ayurvedic nutrition in a later slide, but we really need to think about the qualities of the food that we eat in terms of how they would affect Vata, Pitta, and Kapha in terms of making choices. And then obviously the climate for Kapha that would be the best would be a warm but dry climate. Remember with Vata, we said a warm but moist climate, but for Kapha, warm, dry climate. So a desert would be a perfect, you know, like living in Arizona or something would be great for a Kapha individual. Whereas for a Vata individual, the warmth of the desert is good, but the dryness would not be good, because the dryness would aggravate some of the inherent qualities of dry that are part of Vata. So, but dry would be good for Kapha in terms of helping to counterbalance a lot of the inherent moistness. So I packed a lot of information into one slide. It's a little bit dense, but this is a kind of reference point for thinking about, in a very big picture way, how does the Constitution affect the choices you make in terms of eating, sleeping, where you live, the clothes you wear, and so on. Yes? Those are actually different. Oh, the question was, do the little graphics that I have with vata, pitta, and kapha have any specific meaning? No, these are actually all mandalas within the Vedic system. And so I just tried to pick, they're not specifically connected to vata, pitta, and kapha, but I tried to pick colors that are represented as the colors that are the best suited or the most representative of vata, pitta, and kapha. So for example, pitta has a lot of fiery colors in this mandala. It has a lot of oranges and reds and so on. Vata has this sort of some of the cooler colors in terms of the purples and the blues and so on. And then the kapha has a lot more of the sort of green, grounded earth energy in it. So those are the reasons that I did pick these. But in fact, in terms of meditative practices, when we've been talking so far mostly about mind-body parameters. But remember I said that vata, pitta, and kapha also have more subtle sort of metaphysical parameters and aspects as well. And so these mandalas, if you were going to try and prescribe a meditative practice for each of these three predominant types, we might actually pick a symbol for that person to meditate on, which would be the counterbalance, actually, you know, to that person's predominant constitution. So rather than giving this particular mandala to a pitta, which might actually sort of aggravate some of the pitta qualities, I might actually pick something that had cooler colors in it, or something that counterbalanced the qualities of pitta. So I just wanted to bring some of this information together into a clinical example, in terms of an example of how I might use some of this information when I work with patients. So since I'm a psychiatrist by training, I have a lot of patients that come to me because they are experiencing some kind of psychological distress in their life. And they're drawn to the Ayurvedic paradigm to try and understand what they're going through, and interested in seeing how the lifestyle choices they make might be able to help them with their distress. So I just wanted to give you this clinical example in terms of using depression, for example, as one way of understanding how dosha imbalance might manifest. So I'm going to just give a little story, a little vignette about a family with three sisters. And the three sisters come from a very, very close-knit family, a close-knit Midwestern family. I actually grew up in Michigan, so I knew a lot of close-knit Midwestern families. And the three sisters are all getting together one winter for a holiday gathering. And then the gathering goes on late into the night, and so eventually it's time to say goodbye. And one of the sisters takes off in her car and drives back home. Unfortunately, it's a very, very slippery, icy road on the way home, and as she's crossing a bridge, she gets into an accident and runs her car over the bridge, and tragically, she dies. So this is obviously a huge event in this family of close-knit sisters, and the other two remaining sisters are just incredibly grief-struck by the passing away of their third sister. So the two remaining sisters I'm going to call Alice and Bertha. So Alice, to begin with, is a very creative person. She actually works as a web designer, and her lifestyle is the epitome of vata aggravation. You know, she has these deadlines to meet all the time where she stays up late and doesn't eat and hardly gets any sleep, but she gets a lot of enjoyment out of the work that she does because it's a lot of spontaneous, on-the-fly thinking, a lot of creativity. It really calls for a lot of flexibility. So Alice, this is the kind of work that she loves, but she also has to work really hard to make sure she takes care of herself properly because that lifestyle that she's in has a tendency to aggravate vata. So after her sister dies, unfortunately, this aspect, this vata aggravating aspect of her life really takes off. So what she does is she throws herself into her work to try and cope with this tragedy because she really just doesn't understand how to deal with this. She just feels completely blown away. And so she says, well, I'll do what I know how to do, and that's my work. And that I'll just bury myself in my work. So she takes on more and more projects, literally is driving herself, you know, to the bone with like no sleep at all. She's losing weight. She's already slim to begin with, but she loses like 30 pounds in the course of 6 months, and she doesn't have that much weight to lose, so she becomes really, really gaunt. She can't sleep at night. She's tossing and turning. Her mind won't turn off. She's anxiously thinking ahead to the next day and to all of the problems that she might have to solve. So she's losing sleep. She's losing weight. She's anxious all the time. She can't sit still. She's really just grief-stricken about her sister, but she just literally can't sit still. You know, whenever she sits down for 1 second, she jumps up and goes to some other place and so on. She gets on the phone. She talks a mile a minute. She calls up, you know, her family all the time, but she just rattles into the phone. And as soon as the person, you know, tries to intervene and say a word, they can't get a word in edgewise. You know, they might say, well, what do you think about getting to bed on time tonight or something? And then she'll just move on to the next thing and say, but I can't do that because I have X, Y, and Z, you know, thing, that a deadline that I have to meet, and blah, 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 blah. And she'll just go on and on and on. And so as much as she reaches out and tries to get help, she actually can't take much in her very, very anxious, agitated, sort of, you know, restless state that she's in. And so sure enough, you know, after a few, you know, after her sister's death, about 3 or 4 months after her sister's death, she's just completely exhausted. She just, you know, literally, you know, passes out at work one day and, you know, is sent home, and she's told to take a leave of absence, and she says, okay, very grudgingly, but she goes home and she doesn't know what to do with herself. You know, she's just flitting around the apartment, trying to keep herself, you know, occupied, but nothing gets done. And pretty soon she ends up, you know, in her doctor's office, and her doctor says, well, I think you have depression. And I think you have what we would call an agitated depression. And she says, oh, I didn't realize, because I'm very active. And I think about a depressed person as someone that's very, very slow and can't think or can't move. But no, in the Western, you know, Diagnostic and Statistics Manual definition, she meets criteria for major depression. So that's Alice, okay? So let's just kind of keep her in mind on the back burner for a minute. Then her other sister, Bertha, also is very grief-stricken by the death of their sister. And the sister that died, let's just call her Carrie. So Carrie's death profoundly affects Bertha. Now, before Carrie's death, Bertha was one of these really home-loving, gregarious, warm, welcoming people. She has something like 4 children at home. She loves the holidays because that's like her time to really shine. She doesn't have a job outside of the home, but she makes homemaking into a full-time job that's just brimming with welcome and love and joy for everyone. And so for her, you know, she loves cooking, she loves taking care of her kids, she loves making her home physically a comforting place to be. She puts a lot of thought and energy into having comfortable chairs and comfortable decor and so on and so forth. And so for her, you know, when she learns about Carrie's death, you know, she's a person that's also very hefty in her build. So we can say that, you know, to begin with, she's a sort of the embodiment of Kapha in many ways. And so when she learns about Carrie's death, she's also grief-stricken, but because she is constitutionally who she has a tendency to react in a certain way in terms of how she deals with the stress. And so because she has so much Kapha within her constitution, what she tends to do under stress or under pressure is that she starts overeating. So she starts like buying huge boxes of chocolates and keeping them at her nightstand and just eating, eating, eating. She doesn't get out of bed the way she, you know, used to first thing in the morning and takes care of her home. Instead, she sort of oversleeps, overeats. When she does get out of bed, she has a very hard time getting moving. Everything is sort of slowed down and much more effortful for her. It feels to her like almost like even her thinking is slowing down. Like she feels almost paralyzed in her thought process. She has a hard time sort of planning out her day and thinking about what to do next. And her children are really, really worried because this is so different from her usual loving, warm, gregarious self. She still is in the home as she was before, but now she's almost just kind of confined herself to one room, you know, and sits there watching TV with the curtains shut and eating chocolates and not doing much during the day at all. And this is a huge change from her usual self. So in the Western model, Bertha also has major depression. And it's a kind of interesting thing, because we might say this is the melancholic subtype of depression. We might say this is a subtype of depression. But both of these individuals have depression. Both of them may be prescribed the same cognitive behavioral therapy. They might be prescribed the same medications. They might be prescribed, or they might be taught some of the same techniques in terms of how to deal with their depression. But in Ayurveda, we would say, these two people are actually experiencing two very different phenomena. We would say that Alice is actually experiencing what we would say is vata excess or vata aggravation, because all of these qualities that she's manifesting in terms of anxiety, insomnia, loss of appetite, that sort of compulsive moving and talking, those are all manifestations of vata being too aggravated and too exacerbated in that person. And we would can say that this is a very different phenomenological picture, actually, from the person who has the kapha excess. So Bertha, we would say, is suffering from kapha aggravation. And so in the Ayurvedic worldview, we would look at these two individuals, look at their baseline, and we would see that Alice had a lot of vata in her baseline. So it kind of makes sense that under stress, her vata aggravating activities are what gets her into trouble in terms of the way her reaction to her sister's death manifests. And then similarly with Bertha, she has a lot of kapha in her inherent constitution, so she's going to tend towards more kapha response, we might say, in terms of how she deals with stress, kapha aggravating factors in terms of how she deals with her stress. And in Ayurveda, we would then treat each person in a very, very different way. So in Ayurveda, remember, what we would do is look at which dosha is off balance compared to their baseline, and then work at every level possible to bring whichever dosha is out of balance back into balance. So for Alice, what we would do is recommend a whole series of detoxification procedures that are called panchakarma to help bring vata dosha down. And so that might include, for example, Ayurvedic massage with certain medicinal oils intended to bring down vata. We might prescribe certain yoga asanas, but again, the yoga asanas in Ayurveda, that every single asana in the yoga world has a specific effect on vata, pitta, and kapha. So we would pick vata-lowering yoga asanas. So not everyone should actually do all of the asanas in terms of having the same effects. So we would, and pranayama, which is the breathing exercises in yoga. So we would give vata-soothing pranayama exercises, vata-soothing yoga asanas. We would give meditative exercises for vata that are intended to help ground that person. So, for example, some of you have probably heard of an empty bowl meditation, where the idea is to try and sort of empty your mind of all thoughts. That is not a good technique for a vata-aggravated person, because vata has way too much space and air as part of their inherent constitution. So for a vata person, it's much better to meditate on a particularly grounding or soothing word or soothing image for them that helps them to feel grounded and connected rather than dispersed and fragmented and out in space. So I might ask them to imagine the face of someone whom they really love in a very unconditional way, or think about a word which brings them a lot of comfort and grounding, and ask them to meditate upon that as opposed to an empty bowl meditation. So again, we really need to take who the person is into account. And then again, in terms of sensory experiences, really making sure that they put themselves in environments where they have a lot of warmth, the vata person, to counterbalance that vata aggravation. Social experiences. So just to sort of pick, like if a vata person has a choice of going to a really loud, stimulating rock concert, versus having a long soak in a tub for the night, with maybe, with a close friend or something, going to the hot tubs and having a good long soak for a while, I would say do the hot soak, for the person with vata aggravation. For the person with kapha imbalance, I might go ahead and say, yeah, go to a rock concert. It might help stimulate you a little bit. You have a little bit too much of that stagnation and stasis right now in your constitution. And then attention to nature is actually a big part of Ayurveda. Ayurveda is exquisitely tuned in to how not only does the immediate environment of the person in terms of like weather and so on affect them, but also what time of day is it? What season is it? So some of you have already heard about Chinese medicine here, right, in this talk. So in the Chinese specification of the day, I think the day is cut into like 2-hour chunks in which different organs are affected at different times. Well, in the Ayurvedic paradigm, every part of the day is split into 4-hour intervals, which are vata or pitta or kapha dominant. So for example, pitta time is from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. and also again from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. And so that's the time when if you're going to be doing something that requires pitta energy, that's the proper time to do it. So digestion, you know, is like eating meals, eating your lunch, which is supposed to be the biggest meal in Ayurveda, that should be done between 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. because that's the pitta time of day. If you try and eat a big meal at a different time when it's not pitta, your digestive fires are not going to be as strong, and so you're going to have more problems in terms of being able to digest your food and assimilate it properly. And then similarly, in the nighttime from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. is when they say the highest quality sleep happens in terms of being able to process and assimilate, you know, all of the events of the day. You know, a lot of REM sleep happens, you know, in terms of phases in the night. And if you don't have good quality REM sleep, you don't actually end up feeling like you've had a restful sleep. And so there's really something very interesting about this Ayurvedic worldview that if you don't sleep between those hours, you know, the quality of your sleep may be disturbed. And I've often found that if I miss my bedtime and if I stay up a little bit too late and it's like midnight or something, then it's very hard again to go to sleep. You've kind of crossed over into that pitta time, and pitta is very fiery and awake and sharp, and so sometimes I get my best work done at that time if I'm up late, but it's also not such a great time, it's not so great to then sleep after that and not be having the best quality sleep that I could be having. So anyway, so Ayurveda also really wants each person to think about their day and think about aligning their activities in such a way that vata, pitta, and kapha can sort of help them with their activities. So you can either swim with the current or you can swim against the current. And you can always swim against the current, but you know, why swim against it if you can swim with it and get more productive work done? And so in working with a person with vata dosha imbalance, I might really get them to think about, okay, you know, in terms of the vata times in the day, go ahead and do what you need to do in terms of activity because the vata energy will kind of help you. But then when it's the kapha time of day, don't pick a vata, you know, a sort of a vata type activity to do at a kapha time. So really try and match the time of day to what the quality of vata pitta is for that time. You can roughly divide the day like this. And in Ayurveda, everything is determined by sunrise and sunset. So this will also change according to the season in terms of when sunrise and sunset is. But let's just say roughly that, you know, sunrise is at 6 a.m. and sunset is at 6 p.m. So if we divide up the day like that, then we can say that roughly from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m., it's kapha time, this is pitta time, this is vata time, and then from 6 p.m. to, let's say, 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. So this is again pitta here, and this is vata, and this is kapha. So just roughly speaking, so 6 a.m., we say in Ayurveda that you should try and get up before the sun, before the sunrise, because vata is active from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. So if you're able to wake up just before the sunrise, you have the energy of the day kind of working with you to wake up. But if you turn off that alarm, you hit the snooze button, and then it goes into like 7 or 8, it's much harder to wake up sometimes. And that's because Ayurvedically we say that we're in the kapha time. Kapha is predominating then at that time. And so kapha is a little bit slower, you know, it's a little bit more sleepy or a little bit more lethargic. And so if you're not already awake, This makes it much more of a challenge. But if you are awake, then that's the best time of day in the morning. It's a slower time. It's more deliberate time. It's the best time of day to meditate, to reflect upon the day, to sort of calmly prepare, you know, for what you're going to be facing in the day ahead. So generally we say in Ayurveda, you should have a nice, slow, kind of calm start to be in harmony with kapha this time of day. And then from 10, I didn't put the 2 p.m. here, sorry. Then from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. is pitta time. So the meal, your meal time should definitely fall here in the middle of that. But in addition to meal time, pitta time is like when, if you have to really do some kind of like serious thinking about something and really make, you know, an executive decision and really weigh all the pros and cons of something and come up with a plan for the day or a sort of an agenda, this is good time. From 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. is kind of like maximal productivity time from the standpoint of cognitive functioning. And then from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. is vata time again. So then this is vata's, remember, the energy of movement. And so this would be a good time of day if you wanted to exercise, if you wanted to do something that also involved some sort of creative brainstorming, for example. Like pitta time in terms of cognitive decision making is much more about coming up with a plan and being able to like formulate, you know, a schema for something. But vata is more like free-flowing brainstorming, creative imagination kind of time. So after lunch, from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. That sort of makes sense, too. After lunch, a lot of us can't, you know, necessarily make the best decisions sometimes because we're a little bit slower, too, as we're digesting our food. But in terms of just more free-form imagination, that's considered to be more vata time. And then kapha time is, again, from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. So then again, this is considered to be a time of day where you sort of slow down again. So you finish all the activity as much as possible by 6 p.m., you generally in Ayurveda, we really try to also finish the meal. The last meal of the day is supposed to be finished by about 6 p.m. And then kapha time is considered to be here more of a time, again, for to spend with your family, to sort of bring the people that you love close to you, to be more sort of calm and reflective and loving with the people in your life. And then you really want to go to bed before kapha goes away. Because the kapha energy is from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. So if you can optimally have your bedtime somewhere in there, then you're kind of working with nature's rhythm in terms of allowing yourself to fall asleep naturally and calmly and peacefully. And then pitta time here is sort of like the deep sleep with lots of dreaming and important assimilation of the day going on here. And then from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m., vata is starting to move again. And so somewhere in here, waking up should happen. I just wanted to talk a little bit about four modalities within Ayurveda and just very, very quickly touch on some of the studies that are starting to be done to validate this particular system of medicine. And so the four areas I'm going to be looking at are Panchakarma, which is the detoxification procedures in Ayurveda, the herbal therapies in Ayurveda, yoga from an Ayurvedic standpoint, and then meditation from an Ayurvedic standpoint. So first of all, it's probably not going to be a surprise to most of us that most of the Ayurveda research being done worldwide is not happening in the United States. It's happening in India, which makes a lot of sense, but also Britain, Germany, and Australia actually have a pretty large amount of data that's starting to get accumulated in the past 3 or 4 decades on Ayurveda. So unfortunately, the U.S. is sort of behind the times, but hopefully we'll catch up soon. I actually visited a couple of years ago a large Ayurvedic medical center in India, and I just wanted to show you a few slides from that. This is at the National Institute of Mental Health and Neuroscience. It's called NIMHANS, and it's sort of India's version of the NIMH. So it's really like the national center for mental health treatment and research. And I was just really surprised to find that they have an entire building that's dedicated just to Ayurvedic and yoga therapies. And so they provide conventional care for neuropsychiatric illness, but they also have like this entire section that's also devoted to using Ayurvedic and yoga therapies for neuropsychiatric illness. So in this Ayurvedic paradigm, Panchakarma is supposed to be a very, very important way of resetting the body after it's been off balance for a long time in terms of one particular dosha becoming too aggravated. And so depending, you know, if someone has only had, you know, symptoms or has only been off balance for just a few weeks or something like that, or even a month or two, they will probably not require Panchakarma. But many people have long-standing dosha imbalance that's just been going on for years and years. And so particularly when that's the case, Panchakarma is considered to be very, very important in terms of removing the subtle and gross toxins that have built up as a result of the doshic imbalance. And so Panchakarma is a series of detoxification procedures. And so one of them is here, Shirodhara, which is a pouring of a stream of medicinal oils onto the center of the forehead. And this is considered to be a very, very subtle treatment, because within Ayurveda, this place between your two eyes, just as in the yogic model, is considered to be a point of great importance in terms of the convergence of different energetic points. And so when someone is suffering particularly from vata imbalance, this is considered to be a very important point in terms of soothing with medicinal oils. And so there's an urn into which a particular formulation of medicinal oil is created that's specific to that person's constitution, and then it's poured in this gentle stream over the forehead for about 45 minutes to an hour. And it might sound sort of torturous, but actually it feels incredibly soothing when you're going through it. This is actually a young man with schizophrenia who's being treated with Shirodhara. And then medicinal massage, Abhyanga and Svedana. Svedana is steam treatment. So Abhyanga with medicinal oils and then followed by steam treatment is another very important aspect of Panchakarma. So the types of oils that are used are, again, dosha-specific for that individual. And it's not always just oils that are used. Sometimes it's yogurt, sometimes it's sand, sometimes it's salt. Depending on what the qualities are that you're trying to balance in that person, many different types of substances can be used in this massage treatment. And then this is usually followed up by a steam treatment. Here, this person is immersed in a steam chamber, but even if they don't have a steam chamber available, they might be asked to just sit in a small room in which a small cauldron with water is allowed to just steam up the room, and then they just stay in that room for, you know, 30 minutes or so until the oils or whatever have been applied to their body are well absorbed. And then nasya is another important part of Panchakarma. And nasya is a nasal application of medicinal oils. So this can be done either by just directly pouring some drops into the nose, or by saturating a cotton ball in a particular medicinal oil and then putting it in the nasal cavity. And then the ethmoid sinus is a little, there's a cribriform plate right behind the nose here that actually is a very thin bony separation between the brain and the nose. And so the medicinal oils very quickly actually enter the central nervous system through this route. So, what I didn't also put here, in addition to nasya, we also have enemas and purgative treatments, which are a big part of the Ayurvedic cleansing system. So the idea behind that is that you use a variety of these different, you use svedana, you use the massage, you use the nasal application of oil, you use the shirodhara. All of these things are said to sort of pull the toxins out of the tissues and concentrate them into the GI tract. And then you use purgative and enemas to sort of flush out those toxins that end up being concentrated there via these other routes. And so these are very, very important in terms of the final paths of elimination for these toxins. But I chose not to show you photos of those. So Panchakarma studies are actually amazingly large in number. We don't see a lot of them here in the U.S., but there's actually literally just hundreds of these Panchakarma studies that have been compiled over the last 40 or 50 years in India. And there's a great book that I cited here called the very bottom one, The Scientific Basis for Ayurvedic Therapies, which the CRC Press put out a couple of years ago. And this particular editor has just done a fabulous job bringing bringing together all the different studies that have been done within the different disciplines and that are available in the English language and put them together into a nice chapter summary for various body systems. And so I'd really encourage any of you that are really interested in looking at this in more detail to take a look at that book. So most of those studies have been done in India, but I just wanted to touch on a couple of other studies, actually one other study in particular that was done here in the United States, and that was the second one from the bottom, the controlled clinical trial of toxic occupational chemicals. So out in Iowa, which is a big agricultural state in the United States, it turns out that agrochemicals seep into the groundwater and are very, very commonly ingested by the population in those areas. And so if you go around and actually measure serum levels of these toxic agrochemicals, they're very, very high in certain farming communities within Iowa. And unfortunately, these chemicals are such that they really are not very rapidly excreted out of the body. They're kind of bound in fatty tissue for a long time. So typically, the rates of excretion might be something like less than 0.5%, you know, every few months. And so you end up actually, you know, basically carrying these chemicals around with you for decades once you're exposed to them through food and through groundwater and so on. And so there was a very interesting Ayurvedic study that was done where they went to Iowa and looked at, I think it was like 60 subjects and divided them into two groups. And one group was 30 subjects, and they were just followed for 2 months. They had their serum blood levels drawn at the beginning of the two-month period and then again at the end of the two-month period. So one group just really had no intervention done, just had their blood drawn at the beginning and at the end. The second group actually had a series of panchakarma treatments done, and these panchakarma treatments were specifically designed to try and draw out these toxins and eliminate them from their body. And so after 2 months, they compared the serum blood levels of the group that had gotten the panchakarma with the control group, and it was pretty amazing. There was apparently a 50% reduction in the agrochemical levels in the group that had undergone the panchakarma, and the control group in that same period of time had something like less than 1%, you know, change in their serum levels. So there really is something to these ancient procedures. We're not always able to explain how they might work from a Western standpoint, but it's pretty hard to argue with some empirical findings like that in terms of efficacy. The other study above that I wanted to just mention, the open controlled trial with Parkinson's disease, this is actually an important study in that it demonstrates that when you are trying to do an Ayurvedic treatment for some condition, it's very important to look at the Ayurvedic treatments as a whole kind of system of treatment, as opposed to trying to just extricate out one component of the treatment and use that alone. So in this particular study, it was a very small, the N was very small, so it's not by any means a definitive study. It was also an open control trial, which means that subjects knew what they were getting in terms of intervention. But still, I think it really points to an important concept, which is that the whole package of treatments that you might give a person to bring down their dosha is more effective than just doing one alone by itself. So in this study, people with Parkinson's received either panchakarma plus an Ayurvedic herbal remedy for Parkinson's, or they had only the herbal remedy for Parkinson's. And then they were followed over a certain period of time, and then symptoms were looked at, you know, at the end of the study period. And the group that had gotten the panchakarma plus the Ayurvedic herbal treatment had much more marked improvement in terms of Parkinson's symptoms than the folks that had gotten only the herbal remedy. So this just really points to the importance of considering the system as a whole and not just trying to extricate out one element. And Ayurvedic herbal treatments are just huge in Ayurveda. I mean, it's just a huge topic. When I went there, this is an Ayurvedic school that I took some photographs in. The students in this particular class are required to learn how to cultivate and prepare and preserve 600 different herbs, and then using those 600 different herbs, combining them into literally thousands of different polyherb formulas. And so they have this base of 600, and then they use that base of 600 to formulate a whole bunch of other polyherb formulas. But they literally have to grow that herb at their school, so they have to understand all the factors that grow into the proper cultivation of the herb, when to harvest it, what what part has the, you know, active, you know, medicinal ingredients, what parts are toxic, what parts aren't. If there's something toxic, how do you convert it into something that's usable? And then how do you prepare it? And then how do you mix it with other herbs safely and so on? So it's just a huge endeavor. And I was really quite impressed with their knowledge. In Ayurveda, as I said, there's just literally thousands and thousands of combinations of herbs, so I can't really even begin to get into the specifics there. But since I'm a psychiatrist, I'm interested in some of the herbs that have more psychotropic effects. And so I listed for you some of the main psychotropic effects on the right-hand column there. And then the herb names are written here in Latin, but I've also given the Sanskrit name on the picture of the herb. And on the right-hand side, the Latin name, whenever there's a little asterisk next to it, it means that it's actually been found to have that particular effect from a series of randomized controlled placebo-controlled trials. Randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled trial. But the ones that do not have the asterisk next to it indicates that this is a traditional use, an indigenous use of that herb, which has not yet undergone the kind of rigorous scientific testing that the others have. So I just want to just give you a quick, you know, look at some of these. I think the ones that a lot of my patients are actually the most interested in are the very bottom, the cognitive enhancement ones. A lot of folks that are very, very interested in how to improve their memory and their cognitive functioning. And this is actually an area of probably some of the most studies that are coming out in the Western world. Bacopa monnieri, which is called Brahmi, and Withania somnifera, which is called ashwagandha. Those are the two. Ashwagandha and Brahmi are probably the two that are getting the most attention. So those might be the ones to sort of keep your eye on. And then I just listed here just for your reference. You can look it up in that scientific basis for Ayurvedic therapies if you'd like. But I've just listed some of the other medical conditions that also have some very good evidence base behind them in terms of treatments with Ayurvedic herbs. So, for example, Parkinson's disease has pretty good data on mucuna pruriens as a treatment. All of the studies that are listed here are placebo-controlled double-blind studies, so these are pretty good quality studies. But there's lots and lots of like case reports and open trials too that are supporting some of the uses of these herbs. A quick word about safety issues related to Ayurvedic herbs. There's been a lot of negative press actually in the past year about a study that was done in Boston that came out showing that a lot of these, I think something like 20% of Ayurvedic medicines that were studied in a Boston area Indian grocery store ended up having heavy metal poisons mixed in. And so this is, you know, obviously concerned a lot of people. And I just wanted to address that a little bit here. Because first of all, as Ayurveda has become better known worldwide, the demand for Ayurvedic herbs has just really, really escalated. And so unfortunately, a lot of herbs are getting sent out from India, which are not actually prepared according to traditional methods for detoxification. And they're just sort of being mass produced and being shipped abroad. And I don't think this is a good thing. Because first of all, remember we talked about Ayurveda being very, very tailored to the individual person, to who that particular doshic constitution of that person is. And when you start talking about, you know, one herb for all people for a particular condition, you're getting very much into just like a conventional Western model, which does not take into account who that person is, you know, which dosha is affected, what are the factors that might to be considered in terms of adjusting this herb or that herb for that individual. And so mass production of over-the-counter Ayurvedic herbs is just a bad idea. And I think that that's unfortunately one of the things contributing to sort of problems in terms of side effects and poor use of these herbs. But the other thing that I wanted to say is that in Ayurveda, many times actually things like mercury, things like gold, silver, they actually are used in the production of these Ayurvedic herbs and or medicines. And they can be very, very powerful. But they also have to undergo a very rigorous detoxification procedure in order for them to be considered useful. So in Ayurveda, everything is considered potentially a medicine under the sun, but everything is also considered potentially a poison. And so the only difference between a poison and a medicine is how skillfully the preparation is done and whether it's applied properly. So if you have the preparation done incorrectly or you apply it in the wrong context, then what could be a potent medicine becomes a poison and vice versa. And so it's very, very important to understand that in the traditional Ayurvedic training, which actually took 12 years, and you had to be an apprentice, you know, for years with a master practitioner before you could go out on your own and do this stuff, you had to detox it. Learning detoxification was actually very, very critical. They have these formulas called samskaras for how you detoxify something like lead, for example, or mercury to make it usable. And when you bypass those detoxification methods and you just sort of throw in some lead into the herb, into the medicine, it's not medicine. You're not preparing it properly and you're not applying it properly. And so a lot of the contaminants, unfortunately what they found in the Boston study, a lot of it was just contaminant, frankly. It wasn't even that people were deliberately putting in these heavy metals. They used contaminated water, contaminated soil that the plants were grown in, and so on. So it sort of leached into the product. But other times people do just throw in, you know, trace amounts of these heavy metals because, you know, that's supposed to be part of the medicinal, you know, formula, but they're not preparing them properly. And then also as herbs are sort of being mass-produced, there's a lot of the knowledge base is being lost in terms of the nuances between this herb family, this particular species within this herb family, and so on. And so many times the wrong herbs are even put into these formulas, and it's really becoming a big problem. And also people are combining them in unorthodox ways, that against the samskaras that sort of say this herb shouldn't be combined with this herb because of adverse effects and so on. And so they're just sort of putting things together in this very unexamined way, and it's really causing a lot of problems. I do think that India is very aggressively addressing this. In 2002, they actually passed a law in terms of good manufacturing practices, GMP, that all of their herbs for export have to meet, all the companies that produce Ayurvedic herbs for export have to meet GMP protocols. But a lot of the small mom-and-pop operations sort of bypasses. They send their cousin a bunch of these, you know, Ayurvedic herbs in a bottle to sell in their grocery store. And so they don't end up, you know, coming under the same scrutiny or regulation that the large manufacturers do. So when my patients are interested in Ayurvedic herbs, I tell them to go to reliable large manufacturers that follow GMP so that we know that they're getting a good product. And some of the ones that I recommend are Himalaya Healthcare and Banyan Botanicals. Om Organics is another one. These are all good brands in terms of, first of all, cultivating their herbs organically, so they're not using pesticides and fertilizers that are going to add contaminants into the product. I'm just going to move on really quickly to Ayurvedic nutrition, because in Ayurveda, the idea is that food is medicine, that what you take in the form of food is something that should fit your constitution, that should be in harmony with your constitution. So there's a very, very elaborate list of food groups, you know, for vata, for pitta, for kapha, to sort of to target vata pacification, pitta pacification, and kapha pacification. So if someone is feeling an imbalance or having an imbalance in one of the doshas, I will go through the list of foods with them and pick the food groups that would be most suited to help bring them back into balance or to help maintain them in balance. And then in addition to the specifics of which food is eaten, there's also like the tastes, the different tastes of the food. In Ayurveda, there's actually six tastes rather than four. The first four we're all familiar with, sweet, sour, salty, and bitter, but they have two additional tastes in Ayurveda. One is pungent, so this is like sort of like spicy hot. That's considered, you know, like ginger or cayenne would be a pungent. So that's considered a separate taste in Ayurveda. And then astringent is considered another taste. And astringent is basically something that's very, very drying. And the best example I can think of for that is when sometimes you've eaten a banana that's not ripe enough. You know, you bite into a very unripe banana. You know how it makes your whole mouth sort of pucker up and get very dry and your tongue sticks to the palate, that that's considered an astringent taste. So in Ayurveda, these six tastes actually have a huge effect on the doshas. And so in addition to which fruits or vegetables or dairy products or grains or whatever is eaten, we also try to balance which tastes are taken in. And so I've just listed here a little bit for vata in general, sweet, sour, and salty tastes are supposed to help balance vata. For pitta, sweet, bitter, or astringent tastes are balancing. And then for kapha, pungent, bitter, or astringent tastes are balancing. So it's just, it's a very complex formula to come up with a nutritional plan, but this is kind of a very rough outline of that. And then in yoga, yoga and Ayurveda really are sister sciences. They kind of came out of the same Vedic tradition and were used actually in harmony or in complement with one another originally. Unfortunately, when these disciplines traveled from India to America, they sort of traveled in separate times, carried over by separate teachers who didn't necessarily keep that connection alive. And so now we're sort of having to bring these two disciplines back together as they were originally intended to be used. So in yoga, which includes asanas, pranayama, and meditation, every one of those practices actually has specific effects on vata, pitta, and kapha. So for example, I'm sure many of you are familiar with the sun salutation, the Surya Namaskar in yoga. So the sun salutation is actually, you know, a great series of asanas to do if someone is in very, very good health and, you know, pretty much doesn't have a lot of doshic imbalance going on. But if you do have some kind of dosha imbalance going on, like for example, if your pitta is very, very aggravated, sun salutation is actually supposed to aggravate pitta. Because you're rising in the morning, facing the sun, and doing a lot of heating, stimulating asanas. And if pitta is already aggravated, that's actually sort of the opposite effect that you want to create. And so for pitta aggravation, there's actually, for pitta aggravation, we recommend moon salutations as opposed to sun salutations. And we can actually do a whole series of asanas that are designed to be done under the moonlight that are calming and cooling. As opposed to sun salutations that are stimulating and done in the daytime. And so Ayurveda really tailors which series of yoga asanas are done to meet the individual's doshic balance. And then there's just literally hundreds and hundreds of yoga studies. Unfortunately, a lot of them are very poorly done in terms of scientific standards for having control groups, being randomized, having subjects blinded to which intervention they're getting, and so on. And so they're not necessarily always of the highest quality, but I think the bulk of the studies generally indicate some real efficacy to yoga therapies as a whole for certain conditions. And so I've listed here... in the randomized control trials, I've listed some of the ones that have to do more with mental health, because again, that's an area that I'm interested in. And so there's a particular study that came out, the second one that's listed here in the bullet. The pranayama may be equivalent to tricyclics in treating depressed inpatient psychiatry patients. That was a really interesting study where they looked at a series of yoga breathing exercises, compared them to imipramine, which is a conventional antidepressant medicine, and also compared it to ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, which is also considered to be a very effective treatment for depression. So they had three arms of the study, and they followed the patients for about a month. And at the end of that period, the folks that were in the imipramine group actually had pretty much equivalent results to the people that were in the pranayama, or the yoga breathing group. Neither of those groups was quite as good as the ECT group in terms of improvement, but a lot of people would probably pick breathing over ECT. One critique of that study, though, was that it was done for a very short period of time, 4 weeks. So you could argue that maybe the tricyclic medicine didn't really have a chance to kick in. So maybe it looked as though it was equivalent to yoga breathing because it hadn't been done long enough. And it's possible that if you did it for 8 weeks or 12 weeks, the imipramine group might have looked better than the pranayama group. And so I basically want to replicate that study here at the Osher Center and see if we can do it for a longer period of time and see whether those findings actually would hold up. I've also included in this next slide yoga therapies also for other medical conditions in addition to mental health conditions. So I've listed some of the ones that, again, seem to have some better data in support of the yoga intervention for that condition. But in the comment box where I've written that they have significant co-interventions, that basically just indicates that when the yoga intervention was studied, let's say for hypertension, with asanas and pranayama being the intervention that was done, there were all kinds of other changes that were also implemented at the same time. So it's hard to know whether it was only due to the yoga or whether it was due to other factors that the person's hypertension improved. And so these would be considered to be more sort of questionable studies in terms of what do they really show or what do they really prove about that yoga for those particular conditions. But some of the other ones actually have a little bit more robust findings, particularly the ones for carpal tunnel and osteoarthritis. Those are actually considered to be some fairly well-designed studies. So that's it for my formal talk, and I really want to thank you guys for staying extra a few minutes, and if you have additional questions, I'm happy to answer them.